Okay, we're beginning here on the bottom of Tzadik Vav Amud Bet, six lines up. The Gemara here is trying to understand the Machloket Tanaim that was brought by Rav Shimi Barashi. There was a Machloket whether Mocheret Vikotevet Elulu Mizonol Macharti Veluluk Ktuba Macharti Devei Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda says she should identify why she sold the property, whether she's doing it to fund her Ktuba or she's doing it to fund her Mizonot. On the other hand, Rabbi Yossi says, Mocheret Bekotevet Stam, V'chein Kocha Yafa. Then she should sell it without any identification of what it's for, because then after the fact she can assign it to whatever she needs, and it'll be to her benefit not to identify what it is. So Gemara was trying to understand what is the difference, or what's the Nekudat HaMachloket between Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Yehuda. So Inami, Dekulei Alma Nechsei Bechazkat Yatmei Kaimei. That maybe everybody believes that the Nechassim belong to the Yitomim. Behind the time of the Rabbi Yossi. Then what's the reason behind Rabbi Yossi's position? Kid Abaye Kshisha. Because of the elder Abaye. Damar Abaye Kshisha. Mashal the Rabbi Yossi lema davar domeh. What is Rabbi Yossi's position similar to? The Shchiv Meira. Shamar. A person who's on his deathbed. He gives instructions, his last will and testament. Tnu matayim zuz leploni bal chovi. Please give 200 zuz to so-and-so, who happens to be my creditor. Ratza bechuvo notlan, ratza bematana notlan. The recipient over here can decide when they hand him the money, whether that's just deemed to be a gift, or whether it's considered to be a repayment of the loan. Because the Shchiv Meira did not say, give this money to so-and-so in payment of the loan or the credit that was extended to me. He just identified the individual who you're going to give the money to. So it happens to be that it's his creditor. So he says, please give this money to my creditor. But since he didn't specify that it was for repayment of the loan, the recipient can say, well, he gave me a gift. Now let me make the claim for the loan, the outstanding credit that I have with this individual. Tosfot talks about the different girsaot that are found in the Gemara. It's about how clear he was as an identification of the creditor. But he says from the language and from the Svara, it seems like he wanted to give a gift. Because he would have said it differently had he not wanted to give a gift. And therefore, he can now collect both the gift and he can collect on his outstanding loan. Similar to this woman over here, who can say that the monies were used for her mizonot, and she can still have a full-fledged claim with regards to her ktubah. The advantage being that she will not, after the death of her husband, when she needs to take out mizonot, and he has to go be toref mimishabde, just go take out of encumbered property, property that was already sold, she doesn't have the right to do that for payment of mizonot. She does have a right to do that for the payment of her ktubah. So it's to her advantage to assign the monies or the land that she sold already for mizonot, and then to go after the other individuals, the kuchim, or the buyers of her husband's property for ktubah, because there she has a right to extract the property, even though it's been sold. So for that's the same thing as this. For this guy, if he wants to get the matana after death, he has no rights. If he's trying to go get the loan that he extended after death, then he's a creditor with a previous lien, and he'll be ahead of anybody else who had bought subsequent to his lending the money. So his advantage is to take it as a matana, and then go and make the claim for the loan, not the other way around, not to take repayment of the loan. Said he owed me for the matana, for the Shchiv Meira instructed you guys to give me a matana. But that matana he can't get out of encumbered property. He can't get it out of metaltalin. You have a very hard time getting that. So he is advantaged in assuming that the cash is for the matana, and then going after the other parties for his outstanding loan, his lien, because that he has, in terms of his rights are much more powerful from this credit side than he does from the gift side. And same with the woman. Her rights are much more powerful from the ktubah side, the credit side, than they are from the mizonot side. So she'll deem everything to be for mizonot in order to go with her ktubah. And same thing for this individual. He'll deem this to be the matana, and then he'll go after them for the credit. Because im be matana notlan, lo ikach yafek kuchol. Because if he takes them as a matana, doesn't he end up in a better situation? His outcome will be better for him if he takes it. Now, not that he doesn't deserve both payments. It's clear here from the Gemara, they believe he deserves the payment of the matana, and he deserves the payment for the credit. It's just in terms of his power to collect on either one of them, if he takes the cash as a matana, his power to collect from the loan is much stronger. The same with the woman. If she takes payment for the mizonot, she has a much stronger claim with her ketuba. Not that she's not owed for both of them, but your rights can be exerted in a much stronger way if you utilize it for the thing that has the less of a claim, and then you go after the stronger claim afterwards. So, ketzad mocheret. How do we set up the structure in which the woman sells independent of Beit Din? Remember, this woman is entitled to sell for her mizonot, property of the state that she's liquidating in order to provide mizonot to sustain herself, without the permission of Beit Din, without going through the formal channels of Beit Din. How does she do this? How does she functionally do this? Amar Rabbi Daniel bar Rabbi Katina, Amar Rav Huna, mocheret achat l'shtemasar chodesh. She sells once in 12 months. So we don't have her sell daily, we don't have her sell monthly, because selling off these small parcels of land is not going to garner strong prices or a lot of money. So we have her sell for a whole 12 months, so that she can sell a significant piece of property and sustain herself from that. But, v'lokeach, mefarnes achat l'shloshim yom. The purchaser only pays in 30-day installments. He does not give her all the money up front, the 12 months of money up front, because we're afraid that the money will disappear. Or, more importantly, if she leaves the estate, she takes her ketubah or gets married, then she's not deserving of their entitled to the money afterwards. So because of that, we give her every 30 days. And that way, by giving her the money every 30 days, we ensure that, first of all, it's spent well. There's a sort of budgeting process here. But also ensures that if she leaves the estate, the remaining monies will either go into the estate or be used to redeem the property that was sold. I mean, you're right. Today, if somebody set this up, you would get more money out of it. She would earn a finance charge. But that's the rebate, so she couldn't do it. Rav Yehuda Amar, mocheret l'shisha chodoshim, v'lokeach mefarnes achat l'shloshim yom. So Rav Yehuda has the same structure. He just says that she sells in 6-month installments rather than a 12-month installment. So smaller parcels of property that she's liquidating, but the same structure in which he only gets paid every 30 days. Tanya kavote de Rav Huna. We have a brayta that supports Rav Huna's explanation. Mocheret l'shtemasar chodesh, v'lokeach mefarnes achat l'shloshim yom. She sells for needs of 12 months in one shot, and then she gets paid out on a monthly basis by the buyer. Tanya kavate de Rav Yehuda, a brayta that supports Rav Yehuda's explanation. Mocheret l'shisha chodeshim, v'lokeach mefarnes achat l'shloshim yom. She sells for 6 months worth of needs, and she gets paid on a monthly basis. Amar mei mar yochata, mocheret l'shisha chodeshim, v'lokeach mefarnes achat l'shloshim yom. So Meimar says the halacha is like Rav Yehuda, which is that we sell for 6 months worth of needs, and then she gets paid in monthly installments. Amalei Rav Ashida Meimar, d'Rav Huna amai. How come you paskin like Rav Yehuda? What about the fact that Rav Huna says differently? His opinion is that you sell for 12 months worth of needs in one shot. So Amalei, lo shmi'ali. So I didn't hear what Rav Huna said. Klomar, lo svirli. Whenever somebody says, I didn't hear about Rav Huna, is he saying, I really didn't hear about Rav Huna's position? And had I heard about it, maybe I would have had a different opinion. Or he's basically dismissing it and saying, I never heard about Rav Huna. Not that he didn't hear, but he knew about it and he dismissed it because he didn't think the halacha was that way. Bamine Rav Sheshet. Mocheret l'mizonot mahu. She sells for mizonot. What's the din here? She tachzor v'titrof l'ketubah. So now, in this case, she sells for mizonot. So these purchasers, these buyers, are late in the buying process. Anybody who has a lien in front of them can come and grab this property back from these purchasers. They're buying after the death of this individual. They are now, in terms of the chain of individuals who are entitled to any properties here, they're probably going to be the last in line because they're purchasing property after the death of the individual and after probably claims have been asserted against the estate. So now somebody who has a claim here can go after them because they have a lien that preceded their purchase of the property. But over here, the woman herself is the one that is doing both of these things. She's selling off the property of these individuals to fund the mizonot, but she's also a creditor of the estate because of her ketubah. So now she sells the property to these individuals and then goes after them as a creditor for the property. Is she allowed to do that? That's the question of the Gemara. Kamibai elohu b'drav Yosef. So the question revolves around this issue of Rav Yosef. Dam Rav Yosef. Armalata. The widow who sells property in order to fund the mizonot for the estate, whether it's for the yitomim, whether it's for herself, the achrayut, the recourse, is against the yitomim. Ubeidina de zavin achrayot ayatme, whether she is acting as the executor of the estate, or whether Beit Din is doing it on behalf of the estate, when there's recourse for the buyers, the recourse goes against the tomim. Because Beit Din and the woman don't have property, they're selling on behalf of the estate. So the achrayut, the recourse doesn't go against them, the recourse goes against the estate for which they are executing on, so the recourse goes to the estate. So what's the din here? Kevin achrayut ayat me tarfa. Since when she goes and grabs this property as a creditor because she has her tuba, there's still recourse against the yitomim. So the buyers can't complain because they bought with recourse. Since they have recourse, she can grab the property as a creditor, and then they'll go after the yitomim to get the payout, to get their money back for the property that they bought. Odilma matzi amri lo, nehid achrayut alma lo kabalit ilaveich, achrayut nafsheich milo kibalei kibalt. So listen, young lady, you're selling all this property of the estate. We know that we have recourse against the yitomim for what you sold. But that's with regards to third-party creditors that come in and grab our property away. We have to go after the yitomim to get paid back on the recourse. But if you're the one selling us the property, and you're the one asserting a claim over here, that we cannot accept. There you accepted personal achrayut for. Meaning that they feel like it's improper that she should be the one selling to them, knowing that she's going to come back and grab the property back. Over here, in this instance, they said, similar to the question that we had earlier, if you remember in Reuven, Shemachar Sadeh Shimon, Beli Achrayut. Reuven sold it to Shimon without Achrayut, and then Shimon sold it back to Reuven with Achrayut. And there Rami Bar Chama said, oh, he sold it without Achrayut, too bad. Rava says, no, because he says, listen, when I sold it back to you with Achrayut, I sold it back to you, Achrayut, assuming there was a third party that came in here and took the property. But I didn't sell it back to you with Achrayut that you come and be the problem for me, and then I'm going to guarantee you out because it's your creditor that's coming in here and grabbing the property. So here's the same sort of concept, which is, you're going to say to this woman, listen, in general, I agree that you gave us recourse against the Yitomim. But in an instance where you generate the problem, over there you are responsible. You're personally responsible, and you can't do this. You can't come in here and grab the property that you sold to us before. Tosafot even asks, how is it that Rami Bar Chama didn't know about this Gemara? And based on this Gemara, Rami Bar Chama would be clear that the answer there is, Achrayut doesn't apply. Because here it's clear that we're telling the woman that she is on the hook for this, even though generally she's not on the hook for it. Certainly in the case of Reuven and Shimon, it would be the same thing. So he says over here, because ha ain't a mocher behedja below Achrayut. Over here it's different because she doesn't stipulate explicitly that she's selling it without recourse. The assumption here is that there is recourse. Just a question of who the recourse is against. Is the recourse against the woman or is the recourse against the Yitomim? Over there, Reuven sold it to Shimon explicitly without Achrayut. Over there, Rami Bar Chama suggested maybe it's different. And because he sold it explicitly without Achrayut, that means including his own claims against the property. But nevertheless, Rava says no, that we still, over there, force him to take Achrayut for it. So here's the question. Is she responsible? Is she not responsible in this instance? So now the Gemara says, Amrilei tinitua. It's a braita mocheret veolechet ad kedei ktubata. She's allowed to sell it and go until the value of her ktuba. V'samachla shetikba ktubata min ashar. And then she relies on the residual or the remainder to collect her ktuba from. Shma mina shayra in. Lo shayra lo. If she leaves a residual, she has a right of collection. If she doesn't leave a residual, then she has no right of collection. So what you see from this braita is that she cannot go after the people she sold the property to. She has to leave residual within the estate to collect her ktuba, not go after those people that she already sold the property to in order to fund the estate. So Gemara says, "V'dilma eitza tova kamashmalan." Maybe it's just giving her good advice. "Talo likrei lo hadranita." So they don't call her the backer-outer, the person who reneges on her transactions. Otherwise, she's going to get a reputation as someone who doesn't stand by her transactions. So over here, we tell her, listen, leave yourself stuff over in the estate to collect your ktuba, because if you don't do that, you're going to have to go after parties that you already sold to, and that's going to give you a bad reputation in the market, and then it'll be more difficult for you to sell in the future. So you know that that's an absolute stance, that she's not allowed to go after the individuals she sold the property to. Just telling her, better not to do that because it'll ruin your reputation in terms of your ability to transact in the future. Then the language in the Braita should have been, take your ktuba from the residual. My samachla. What does it mean that that's what she relies on? Shmai mina sheira in lo sheira lo. So from there it sounds like only if she left over that residual, that is somech. Somech is a stronger language of she relies on that. She will depend on that for her tuba. First says gova, which means she's entitled to get it. Whether she takes it from the residual or whether she takes it from the buyers, she's entitled to it. We're giving her advice, leave some stuff over. But the fact that the Braita used the word samachla means a much stronger language of she will depend on that for her tuba, meaning that that's her exclusive right to collect her tuba is out of that residual. Her only option is to take it out of that residual property and not to take it out of those people she sold to. So Yibailo, Zavin velo itzrichle zuze, hadre zvine olo hadre zvine. Individual, they sell the property for money. They need the cash. They're liquidating it because they have a cash necessity. And then all of a sudden, that cash necessity goes away. So a case like this, I mean, obviously in our case, where we're talking about mizonot, to be clear, that she sold it for the needs of the estate, and all of a sudden they don't need it, can they reverse the transaction? But this question is broader, which is in a case where someone has sold it, and this individual, at the time that he sold it and liquidated, had some either business transaction that he was going to enter into, so he cleared the cash so he would have it available for the transaction, or he really wanted this property that was on sale, and so we know that he's selling the property in order to fund this other purchase. So we know that he's liquidating for these purposes, but all of a sudden, the reason goes away. So here he wanted to do a business transaction, and the business transaction disappears. He wanted to buy this property, somebody else bought it before him, or at a higher price, and now he doesn't need the money. So he liquidated it for the cash, and now he does not need the cash. So Hadrei Zvini or Lo Hadrei Zvini, does he have the ability to retract the sale, or not retract the sale? Tashma, Dao Gavro, the Zaben Aro, the Rav Papa, the Itzrichule, Zuze, the Mizban, Tore. This individual sold property Rav Papa, and he needed the cash to buy a shor with it, to buy an ox. Lusof, lo itzrichale. In the end, he did not need the cash. Whatever it was, the shor wasn't available, he didn't need the shor. Whatever the reason is, that transaction didn't happen. Vahadre nihale Rav Papa lare. And Rav Papa retracted the deal, allowed him to take the cash back and give the property back. So Rav Papa, lifnim mishuret adin du avad. Rav Papa was not obligated to do this. Rav Papa was a nice guy. And he allowed him to retract the sale because he knew that he only sold it for that reason. But halachically, he would not be compelled to do such a thing because otherwise, as you're saying, it would lock up the market. People would be reluctant to buy knowing that they could have the transaction reversed on them. So Rav Papa was a nice guy and let him reverse the transaction. But in general, the buyer would not be obligated to reverse the transaction. Tashma. Dahahu bitzurta dava minarda. There was a famine in Narda, or a drought of some sort, so people were desperate to buy food in that time. So they were liquidating their properties, we'll see in a second, in order to get funds to pay for what they assumed would be very expensive food. Sabninu kuleyama apadnayu. Everybody sold their, here they are, these mansions, these rustic mansions. I don't know if these were their summer homes or these were really their homes that they were selling. Basof atuchite. In the end, they got a big shipment of wheat and the prices dropped, plummeted. So when the prices plummeted, nobody needed the cash that they had sold their houses for. They didn't need that much money. They didn't need to sell a house in order to get it. They would have sufficed with their liquid assets to buy what they needed. They assumed there was a drought. In the end, when the food shows up, they realize there's no drought. So Amar Lahu, Rav Nachman, Dinahu, Dehadre, Apadne, Lamarayu. All these transactions get unwound. Because these people clearly sold in order to buy the food that they thought was extremely expensive. In the end, since the food was not at that price, they don't have to stand by the sale. They can reverse the sale. Hatam Nami, Zvine, Bita'u, Tavu. Wait a minute, over there, the problem is not that they're reversing the transaction. There's a mekach ta'ot over here. There's actually a problem in the underlying sale. The igle milta, the arba ba'kule have a kaimo. Because the ship was stuck on the river. What does that mean? The ship couldn't get up river because the water levels were too low. So they had to take them around a more circular route. The chita was coming. It was on its way. It was a mekach ta'ot, which is that the boat normally came in a shorter route and would have been there in time. When the boats don't show up, they all of a sudden think that there's some sort of drought, famine that causes a shortage in the food, and that prices are going to skyrocket. So that's why they all prepared their cash for whenever the food shows up so they could jump on this and buy the food. Turns out that it was just a detour for the boat, and it wasn't the fact that there was a drought. So the mekatel was that all along the wheat was on its way, there was no drought, and it was simply a detour that caused the delay in the delivery or the shipment of the wheat. Hainu damrele rami bar shmuel the Rav Nachman. Imkein nipzeit machshilan latid lavo. This is your question all along. If you allow people to back out of these transactions, then you're going to cause problems in the future, which is nobody will buy in the future. Whenever you're in these situations where people are in need of cash, the chances that you're going to get this sale and keep the property are going to be low because everybody's going to walk away. If things change, then everybody's going to walk away from the transaction. Why would you ever put up the money in that situation knowing that there's a high likelihood that you're going to get knocked out of the transaction? So number one is people won't buy. Then you're going to be in a more desperate situation because in situations where you need the cash, then the discount's going to be significant because nobody's going to enter a transaction knowing that it might get reversed. And so then you actually hurt the sellers because they're going to get lower prices when they're under duress in these situations. So why would you structure a market in this way? You should uphold the sales for the future benefit of all the parties here. Otherwise, in the future, they won't be able to liquidate assets. So Amalei, Ato Kol Yoma Betzorta Shlicha. Right, every day there's a Betzorta, there's a drought, a famine. This is a far-fetched situation. It's a once in a blue moon situation. And so therefore, if we reverse the transactions, that's not going to influence the market because it's such an unusual event. When you have these extreme or unusual events, that doesn't influence the market. You're right. Famines in this area are a frequent occurrence. And therefore, we would want to make sure that the market stays liquid because this is going to happen over and over again. So if this is going to happen over and over again, we want to make sure that people have the ability to sell in these situations. So again, in the case that it's so common that you want to worry about this, the answer is yes, it's a common occurrence. And because it's a common occurrence, we want to deal with it. The halacha is that if he sells the property and he needs the cash, and in the end he doesn't need the cash, he's able to reverse the transaction. Now, two things here. What is the conclusion of the Gemara? Rashi says here, Shvamina. From our case, when he says that a famine in Harda is common, what is the conclusion? So Rashi says, Shmamina, Taima Mishum Mekach Taut Avi. The reason here is that it was a Mekach Taut. Di'i, B'da'atu Chitin Memakom Karov, Oshubal Le'elu Levadam. If it was a case where they got wheat from some close place by, or it just came to them, the Taima Mishum Dezavin, V'lo Yitzrich Le'zuzay, Havimide Lo Shiachu, V'leka Michsho. In that case, it's not a common occurrence, and there's no problem with locking up the market. Over there, we would allow them to reverse the situation. So what Rashi suggests over here is this fact that the boats got detoured happened on a regular basis. And since these boats got detoured on a regular basis, if you allowed them to back out of the transaction, then you'd have problems in the future, and we don't want that to be the situation. So there, we would not allow them to reverse it. So Rashi reads, "Hochi ainu damalei ramash b'shmol the Rav Nachman and came nitzei mashchilin the tadavo is an ichuta." It's not a question of the Gemara, but rather a statement that if you do such, this will be the outcome. And then the question is, "Amalei how to call yomer betzur teshchicha?" Wait a minute, why will that be the outcome? Because is it really true that this happens on a frequent basis? So Amalei, and then he answers in the end, "Yes." In Betzorta Ben Arda, Mishkach Shmicha, it is common in Arda, and therefore there will be a Hachshala Latid Lavo. And therefore, if you allow them to reverse it because of the Mekach Taut over here, then it's going to lead to this problem of people not wanting to transact because of that fear. On the other hand, if the issue here is because they needed the Zuzay, and that's why they were backing out of the deal because you're allowed to back out when that's Zuzay, that's something that's not Shchiach. Since that's not shchiach, it will not lead to a problem of nachshilam natid davo. And because of that, that's why it is mutar to back out of the transaction in that case. And that's the conclusion of the Gemara. The hilchata, the locha is that that case is allowed to back out and you don't need a mekach taot. So Rashi separates between the two different reasons to back out of a transaction. You can back out of a transaction because it's a mekach taot, which means that the underlying transaction that was faulty. Or you can back out of a transaction because the transaction was fine, but the reason for the transaction went away, which is that I don't need the money. So what Rashi suggests is, over here, the reason they allowed them to back out of the transaction was because it was a mekach ta'ot, that the underlying assumption in the transaction was problematic, because the boats were really there. They had a mistaken assumption that it was a drought or a famine. And that's what it's teaching you, that the reason there's an issue over here is because it's a common problem. A common problem that it's a mekach ta'ot of a ulei narda, that they get held up the ships. If it's a common problem, even if it's a mekach ta'ot, you're going to cause problems for transacting in the future. And that was the question. And he says, does that happen often? The answer was, it does happen often. But for things where they have a reason for liquidating for the money, and then all of a sudden they don't need the money anymore, that's an unusual occurrence. Since that's an unusual occurrence, we would allow the transaction to be reversed. And that's the conclusion of the Gemara, that you're allowed to reverse in such situations. So almost the Hilchata seems against what the Gemara says over here. Tosafot takes issue with Rashi. He says, "V'kasha l'peirush zeh, d'mai hochachai." How can you explain it according to Rashi? How is there a proof here? I'll tell you, the reason they backed out of here is not because it's a mekach ta'ot, it's just they didn't need the cash, and that's why they backed out. But it would just be that even more so, where the boats were detoured, because the Daz have a mekach ta'ot out there, that's even more so they should be able to back out of it. Not only did they not need the money, but it was also a mekach ta'ot. And they really is the truth that they ruin it. Because in any case, you're going to back out of the transaction. That's why it's going to cause a problem in the future. Therefore, I would conclude like the Rashbam does, which is, Iyachi kushyuhu. Iyachi is a question and not and an answer, which is, Hoil damar, dahai hadre zvine, dafka mishume kule, abukaime eicha kamar, Betzurta benarda mishka shchiach. Hello, zot betzurta the arbei bekulei avikaim epshita dlo shchiachu. Amalei, have to call yom a betzurta shchicha. So is everything common there? Amalei, in betzurta benarda mishka shchicha. It is common, and therefore we will allow you to reverse these transactions. Meaning that if you think that Rav Nachman's psak is talking about a case in which zavin veloit strichle the zuze hadre, you're allowed to reverse the transaction, then what was the issue that Rami Bar Shmuel had here? Why would it be machshilam le'atid abo? Because atu koyoma betzurta shchicha? Does this happen on such a regular occasion that he would be upset about it? So Amalei, the answer is yes, it happens all the time. And so therefore, the Gemara's conclusion is the reason that Rami Bar Shmuel did not like Rav Nachman's psak is because in their area, this idea that the boats got diverted or had a hard time getting upriver was a common occurrence. And if you did this, you would cause problems in the future. But otherwise, we would paskin like Rav Nachman. In normal cases where it's not so frequent or does not happen so often, we would paskin like Rav Nachman in cases where Zavin, Velo Yitzrikolei, Zuze, Hadre. Because according to Rashi, the conclusion of the Gemara is against the inference. From that case, the inference in that case is you're not allowed to back out of transactions. And then all of a sudden the Gemara goes, oh, halacha is that you're allowed to back out of transactions. So Rashi might claim that that's a case where it's shchiach. Where it's shchiach, we won't let you do it. But in our case, it's not shchiach. But the way that Rashbam learns is, ubishlamai pashtina mina azavin v'lo yitzrich le dezuze adre zvini, hanu vada shchicha, dero pamim ayelem betzorta. They had this all the time. V'nei chanami, fizema, de paskina nilchata, de pshita dabaya. And that's why we would in the end conclude that you're allowed to reverse transactions in this situation. So Tosfot says, now, how do you know when a person is selling for the need of the cash, a person selling because they want to sell the property, or a person selling for whatever reason? How do you know, or how do you make assumptions? So Tosfot creates three categories of reasons to sell property, and each of those reasons will demand a different type of disclosure when you sell the property. So he says over here, ukagon shigila da'ato b'shata mecher. The person made it explicit when he was selling the property, I'm selling the property because I need the cash. For this specific reason, he disclosed the information to the buyer that I'm doing this because I really want to buy this short. As opposed to Rashi, who clearly sees this as being something that's obvious from the context, and you don't need a specific gilui adat in this instance. So then, when the short is not there, he's allowed to reverse it because the buyer knew that information. It was disclosed to him. Because if he didn't say anything, then it would be dvarim shebelev. And dvarim shebelev inam dvarim. In that instance, it doesn't matter that you thought you were selling it for this purpose. Since you did not explicitly disclose it, you can't have the buyer assume that he knows that information. So in that case, you can reverse it if you disclose the information. You cannot reverse it if you did not disclose the information. It doesn't have to be written into the contract. It simply has to be disclosed to the buyer of the property. There are other things that Giloy Dat doesn't work. Even if you disclose the information, that's still not enough. Ad sheyitneh, until you make it a specific condition of the sale. So you'd have to actually demand that it be a part and parcel of the sale of the contract, that it's a condition in the sale, that if I have this issue, then we can reverse it. So Tosfot says, for instance, when a person sells their clothing, they're selling their clothing to make aliyah to Eretz Yisrael. So over there he says, the people don't normally sell their clothing to make aliyah to Eretz Yisrael. That's not a common occurrence. That's not something that the person who's buying the clothing should think of. Oh, the reason they're selling their clothes is because they're moving to Eretz Yisrael. Therefore, if you make an explicit condition in the sale, which is, if I don't make aliyah, the sale is retracted, then that works. If you don't make it explicit, this person should never have thought of it. And if you told them you're making aliyah, that's not a reason for them to assume that if you don't make aliyah, that they're getting their clothing back. On the other hand, as David mentioned before, there is a case coming up, we're going to see in the Gemara, where a person sells their property, and they're going up to Eretz Yisrael. Over there, they don't need an explicit tenai. They don't even need disclosure. It's so obvious that they're selling their property only because they're going up to Eretz Yisrael. If they don't make aliyah, they can retract the sale because it was a given in the sale. Everybody knows you don't sell property. And the only reason these family is selling their property is because they're moving to Eretz Yisrael. If they don't end up moving to Eretz Yisrael for whatever reason, then the property or the sale can be reneged. And you don't even need a giloy dat. You don't even have to have disclosure. It's so obvious from the context in which the sale is being made that that's the reason for the sale, that it's as if there is a disclosure. It's as if this is a built-in condition in the sale because it's so obvious. So that's what Tosfot says. You have to look at every situation and make a determination as to whether the context makes it so obvious that it's almost a built-in condition, or is it something that's so far-fetched that nobody would consider this to be the reason of the sale, and therefore, you would have to explicitly put a condition in the sale in order for it to be there. Or, there's this middle ground, which is disclosure. Where if you disclose it, that's sufficient because people do these things. People sell to get liquid assets to buy something. And all of a sudden, the transaction doesn't happen, so they want to be able to reverse it. Disclosure will be sufficient in that situation. And that's what Tosfot says over here. This is that middle ground where you will need disclosure. And it will be sufficient with disclosure. It wouldn't be enough if you said nothing. It wouldn't be something that demands a tenai, an explicit tenai in the sale, but it's something that does require disclosure. So the assumption here, according to the Tosafot, is that all of these instances where we're asking the question is a question where there was disclosure. For the person knew why they liquidated the asset. They liquidated it because they wanted to buy wheat, and they knew that the wheat would be expensive. They liquidated it because they were buying a shore, another piece of property. So in all these cases, the buyer knew that that was the condition of the sale. It wasn't an explicit condition, but they knew that was the premise of the sale. Next Mishnah. Almana, ben min eusin, ben min esuim, mocheret shelo bebeitin. An almana, widow, who's widowed, whether she's widowed out of the halachic engagement, or whether she's widowed out of full marriage, she can sell without Beit Din's permission in order to garner her mizonot. Rabbi Shimon omer, min esuim, mocheret shelo bebeitin. When it comes to nesuim, she has such a right. But if it's Eusin, she does not have such a right. Ela bebeitin. She has to do it before beitin. Mipnei. And he explains why. Shein la mizonot. Because she's not entitled to mizonot. B'chol shein la mizonot, lo timkor ela bebeitin. Anybody who does not have mizonot doesn't have a right to sell without beitin. With regards to mizonot, we're going to see, mizonot is something that you need on a regular basis. And it's something that you don't want to be ma'akev the woman to get her mizonot. What's she going to do in the interim? While Beit Din gets involved, she's going to starve. She needs to eat in the interim, so we let her sell. In the case of her ketubah, over there, if there's certain delay in her ketubah, that's not going to leave her in a situation where she's penniless and she has nothing to deal with. Ketubah is a more significant amount or sum of money that is of her future. So there, we don't mind there's a delay. So regard to a nisuah who has rights to mizonot and to her ketubah, she can sell for the mizonot without Beit Din. That rusa who doesn't have rights to mizonot only has a right to her ketubah, over there say, wait for Beit Din, let Beit Din take care of the situation. That's Rabbi Shimon's opinion. Bishlama min ha-nisuim. I understand why the Tanakh Kama says min ha-nisuim, you could sell without Beit Din's permission, mishum mizone, because of mizone. Ela min ha-usim, my time, according to the Tanakh Kama, why from eusin do we allow her to sell property? if she's not entitled to mizonot. Mizonot only kick in at the time of nisuin. Samarula mishum china. Ula says, because of chayin, here we have the machloket, Rashi and Tosafot that we find in other places. Rashi says, mishum china, shei balim lachayin beinehem. The men will find favor in the women's eyes, and they will marry. V'lo yimnu'u anashim ilinaseyin anashim. And people, women will not be reluctant to get married because they're afraid that they won't be taken care of in the back end. Right? We want to ensure that the women are taken care of or well taken care of in the back end because they're more willing to enter into marriage situations. If we don't take care of them in the back end, they'll be more reluctant to enter into marriage situations because they have risk then. They won't be able to, if their husband dies, they're not going to be able to support themselves, not going to be able to get their ketubah out easily. So because of that, we want to facilitate an easy exit for the woman in order that she'll be more willing to get married up front. That's the way Rashi learns it. Meaning that if she can collect her ketubah easily after the erusin, and there's not this whole holdup where she's going to have to wait months to get her ketubah, she enters into the marriage because she feels secure that if something happens, she'll get her ketubah. If she feels it's so hard to get her ketubah in the back end, she's going to be more reluctant to get married, knowing that there's a risk that she won't get her ketubah, she'll be held up. Look what happened to that woman. Her husband died in erusin, and now she's been locked up in the courts for all these years. You know, that's something that you don't want to have women feel that they are trapped once they enter into the marriage. That's the way Rashi learns it. Tosafot always thinks the other way. That it's a reason for the women to find chayin in the eyes of their husbands. So Tosafot Reed brings the other side of this, which is Tosafot's reasoning and Rabbeinu Chananel. Perish, k'dei she'ela k'tubata mitzuya. Because then she'll have her k'tuba quickly. Ulai timsachein b'enei anashim tinaseba. That will facilitate her ability to get remarried. It's not for chayin so the women will get married. It's chayin, so the men will take the women. So what do we want to do? How do we facilitate her ability to get married quickly so that she finds favor in another man's eyes? Her ketubah. Her ketubah means that she has assets to bring into the marriage. Her assets in the marriage will then facilitate her ability to get remarried because her husband now will be more willing to get married to her. She has nothing to offer, then he's getting no dowry. Maybe he would not be as willing to marry. By giving her ketubah paid out quickly, that allows this woman to find favor in other men's eyes to get remarried. So that's the chayin. And Tosafot always learns the chayin that the woman is trying to find favor in the men's eyes. Rashi always learns the other way around, that the men are trying to find favor in the women's eyes. So Rashi's explanation is, we want women to get married, so we make it easier for them to get out in the back end, so there'll be more women to get married in the front end. Tosafot's the other way, which is we want to get her paid out quickly, because then she will find favor in other men's eyes. She'll be able to get remarried quickly. So that's one reasoning. Rabbi Yochanan Amar, Fishein Adam Rotze, Shetit Baze Ishto Bebeitin. Person doesn't want his wife to have to be dragged into the courts and to be in a public forum like this. He wants to protect his wife so she won't have to go through this, and therefore he waives, in a sense, the need for her to go to Beitin, allows her to sell without going to Beitin. My Benayu, what's the nafkamina between these two reasons? Ika Benayu Grusha, a divorcee. The one who says it's a chayin issue, grusha nami baya chayin. A grusha still needs chayin. Maybe not as much as an amana, but she still needs chayin. We'll explain that in a second. According to one who says that, he doesn't want his wife to be embarrassed or dragged through a public forum like the beitin. Grusha lo ichpele. If he divorced her, he's not going to worry about that because that's no longer his wife. He doesn't worry about that embarrassment in the back end. So now, according to Rashi, what does that mean, grusha nami bayichain? But grusha needs chain because the takanat chachamim is to have a woman want to get married. Now, if she sees the options in the back end, which is, it's a possibility she's widowed, possibility she's divorced. In the case where she's divorced, it's going to be a miserable situation for her. She'll have to go to Beit Din, she won't be able to liquidate her ketubah. If she becomes an almanah, it'll be okay. That's not going to help to make the women more comfortable that in the back end they're okay. Because if in the back end the grusha runs into a problem, a woman's going to be more reluctant to get married knowing that there's this back end that could be hugely problematic for her. So the chayin is enhanced by even by a grusha being taken care of in the back end, and therefore chayin would apply to a grusha. And that's the way Rashi learns it. He learns it, sharei takanat chachamim hi, lo mi'avat ha'ish. The takanat chachamim is not because of the love of her husband. It has simply to do with she wants to have or know that she has security. Security matters not whether she ends up in an almanah situation or a grusha situation. According to Tosafot, the other way around, Tosafot brings the Rabbeinu Chananel, grusha nafish chein dida, yesh la tosefet. Right? The grusha needs more chein because of the tosefet. Not that she needs less chen, she needs more chen according to Tosafot. Right. According to Tosafot, the whole idea is to precipitate or facilitate her getting married again. An almanah is more appealing than a grusha. So in that situation, we need to extend more chen to her. And that's why chen applies to a grusha even more so than an almanah. That's one way Tosafot explains it. Or the Rabbeinu Chanan explains it's grusha nafish chen dida, the ishla tosefet. That the grusha has this additional chen because she has additional monies. She gets the ketubah. She gets full payment out on her ketubah because she's being divorced. And being divorced, she has all this additional monies. And therefore, her ability to collect it quickly without going to Beit Din will enhance her situation. So that's the difference between them. Now, the Gemara brings Tanan. We have a Mishnah that says, V'grusha lo timkor elo beBeit Din. Grusha can only sell in Beit Din. Bishlama the mandamar the fishin adam rotzesh titbazesh lo beBeit Din. Grusha lo ichbalei. According to Rabbi Yochanan's explanation, that Mishnah makes a lot of sense. Because he doesn't want his wife to have to go through this public issue with going to Beit Din and all the hassles and harassment of going to Beit Din. So therefore, he says, you can collect or you can sell without Beit Din. By Grusha, where he doesn't care. So therefore, go to Beit Din, and it matches with what the Mishnah is saying. Wait a minute. If the problem here is Chayin, why should a Grusha be demanded to go to Beit Din? Hamani, he says, you know who the author of that position is? Rabbi Shimoni. That's Rabbi Shimon. Rabbi Shimon is the one who says in our Mishnah, if you're not entitled to Mizonot, then you have to go to Beit Din. Well, Grusha is not entitled to Mizonot, so therefore she's got to go to Beit Din. So this is under the authorship of Rabbi Shimon, not the Kuli Alma. E Rabbi Shimon ha tanole reisha. Wait a minute, if it's Rabbi Shimon, he explained it. Min erusin lo timkor. From the Erusin, she's not allowed to sell except if she goes to Beit Din. When it's an almanah from the Erusin that the chain is not as extensive, therefore, we would say that's the reason she has to go to Beit Din. About Grusha, the nafish chain dida, that her chain is on a much higher level. So over there, we would say maybe we should require her to have chain and not be able to go to Beit Din. Kamash Malon, according to Rabbi Shimon, still in a case of a grusham and a nisuin, she still needs chayin. Now this is interesting. Rashi explains, what is the lof nafish chayin dida? Sholayt Allah chibat biya. She didn't have the love that is associated with the physical relationship. The lo yirabe inei nashim imichuchozu. Now they won't be so reluctant to enter into marriages, knowing that if they get left from the erusin, they'll have to go to Beit Din. Because Erusin is a case where there wasn't this physical relationship. It was an earlier stage of the marriage. And they will get married knowing that if they get to the consummation of the marriage, they'll be protected. They won't have to go to Beit Din. But, okay, from the Erusin, they'll have to go to Beit Din. That will not be a dissuasion for women to get married. That's Rashi's explanation. According to Tosafot, who says it's the chain for the back end, again, being divorced from the Erusin, it's easy to get remarried. Because that's a woman who is still, in a sense, a bitula. Since she's a bitula, she will be more appealing to the shuk. And going to Beit Din and this chain issue will not be such a difficulty. Whereas she's a nisua already, that's much more a significant issue. Even if she's a grusha, or even sometimes, according to Tosafot, even more importantly, if she's a grusha. So over there, we would have thought that there would be a need not to go to Beit Din. In the end, Rabbi Shimon says, no, she's got to go to Beit Din with regards to a grusha as well. It says, Hanami Tanina. We also know that from Rishima's statement in our Mishnah. Koshein la mizonot, la tuye mai. Anybody who doesn't have mizonot, what does that include? Lav li tuye grusha. Isn't that coming to include a grusha who doesn't have mizonot? And that's what Rabbi Shimon says, you still have to go to Beit Din. Lo. La tuye migreshet, ve'enu migreshet, kud Rabbi Zeira. Now it comes to include a case of someone who is in a safek situation. Safek if she was divorced, safek if she was not divorced. Like Rabbi Zeira. Dami Rabbi Zeira, kom makom shamru migreshet, ve'enu migreshet. Any case where the conclusion of the halacha is that she might be divorced, might not be divorced, she's in this safek, baal chayav b'mizonotah. The husband is responsible for her mizonot. Since he is responsible for his mizonot, in a sense, she would be able to sell things for her mizonot without the permission of her husband. But as Rashi mentions over here, that's qualified. Yashminu matnitin the dafka b'chayav. That's what Rabbi Shimon is going to teach you. Only as long as the husband is alive. When she's left in this limbo situation, he's got to supply her mizonot. You know why? She can't do anything. She can't collect her ketubah because she's a safek. She can't go and get remarried because she's a safek. So this woman is left in limbo and nobody's going to support her. She doesn't have a ketubah. She can't get remarried. and her husband then have her as the supporter. The Baal is Chayiv Mizonot. Mishom Demu Kevet Bishvilo Lehinasei. He is the cause for her problem right now that she can't get remarried is because he left her in this limbo state with regards to the get. On the other hand, if he dies, then it's all over. Whether it was a get or not a get, at this point he's dead, she's not married anymore. So now she's released. If she's released, the husband's no longer chayav in the mizunot. Since he's not chayav in the mizunot, she can't collect her tuba without going to Beit Din. So that's what Rabbi Shimon came to teach us. That chiddush, that the issue that the husband is responsible for mizunot, is only true during his lifetime, while he's alive. So therefore, when he passes away, he's no longer responsible for mizunot, not responsible for mizunot, no tuba without going to Beit Din. And that was the chiddush of Rabbi Shimon on that second piece. Not to teach you about a grusha, but to teach you about this case of migureshe benu migureshe. Rashi gives an example of a case where he threw her the get, and the get lands Suffolk Arba Amot closer to her, Suffolk closer to him. So we don't know if she took possession of the get, or the get remained in his possession. So that's a case of Suffolk, where we don't know if she's divorced, because the get landed in a situation where we don't know if it was in her possession or in his possession. So Tosafot over here says that the conclusion that Rashi is drawing is so obvious, that the fact that the woman is migureshet, ain't a migureshet, is not entitled to collect mizonot from the estate, from the yitomim, is so obvious that that would not be the kamash malon that we would get out of Rabbi Shimon's position. And therefore, Tosafot says that he thinks the Rabbeinu Hananel's interpretation over here makes more sense, which is not like Rashi. Rashi says over here, in the migureshet, ain't a migureshet, is not entitled to collect because she doesn't get mizonot, even though she got mizonot during her lifetime, because she was stuck to him. Now, when he dies, she's released from him, and therefore she's not entitled to mizonot. If she's not entitled to mizonot, she's also not entitled to sell shelo bebeit din her ketubah. On the other hand, Tosafot says, Rabbeinu Hananel says, that the case is latuyeh migureshet v'enu migureshet. Latuyeh is on the positive side. It comes to include a woman who is migureshet v'enu migureshet. Since she gets mizonot during the lifetime of the Baal, she'll be entitled to sell her ketubah after his death, even without the auspices of Beit Din. And so what they're saying here is that migureshet v'enu migureshet is the chiddush is that she is entitled to sell without Beit Din, even though she doesn't get mizonot. Because she's not entitled to mizonot. She's no longer a guda bey. Of course she doesn't get mizonot. So you would have thought maybe she shouldn't be able to sell without Beit Din because she doesn't get mizonot. Or if we let her sell without Beit Din, maybe she'll take mizonot. The answer is no. That's the chiddush of Rabbi Shimon, that we allow her to sell without Beit Din and we don't worry about those issues. Alright, Tashma. Kishem shemocheret shelo bebeit din, kach yorsheha, yorshei ketubata, mochrim shelo bebeit din. Just like she has a right to sell not in Beit Din, so too, the individuals who are the inheritors of her ketubah, meaning her male children, mochrim shelo bebeit din. They are also entitled to sell not in Beit Din. Bishlaman the mandam er lefishin adam rotzei shetib bazei ishto bebeit din. According to Rabbi Yochanan, who says that's the reason, just like he doesn't want his wife to be embarrassed, then have to go through this public, dragged through the court system. So he wants to protect her. He also wants to protect her, Yorshim, her male children that are going to be Yorshek Tubata. He wants to protect her. He also wants to protect her offspring. So therefore, the reason is applicable not only to her, but also to her Yorshim. Alamanda mar mishum china. If the problem here is chayin, Yorshah, my chayin ikah. What chayin applies to the Yorshim? Now, according to Rashi, that means no woman is going to be reluctant to get married because of the possibility that, in the end, her Yorshim will have to end up in Beit Din collecting money. She's gone from the picture in that case. It's no longer her issue. It's her Yorshim's issue. Person doesn't think that far out to say, I'm not going to get married because of the possibility that, in this situation, that my Yorshim might have to go to Beit Din. That's not enough for a reason to hold her back. According to Tosafot, she no longer needs to get remarried. She's not here anymore. So if she's not here anymore, then the chayin is not an issue because she's not trying to get remarried. It's simply the Yorshim that are trying to collect on the money here. Right? It's a monetary question, not a remarriage question. So Targum Ha'ula, Kigon Shir, Ashta, Bita, O Achota. Where it says, no, we can create a situation in which it becomes an issue of chayin, which is it's her daughter or her sister that are inheriting her. The nearest of kin was not a male. It was a female. So in that case, for Tosafot, maybe that will help her get married. That will give money to these individuals so that they will be able to get married easier. According to Rashi, it is, this might be something that causes women not to get married. If this sister or this daughter has to be dragged into Beit Din in order to get her sister or mother's tubah, that might make them reluctant to get married. Because they say, look what happened when my sister or mother passed away. They have to go to Beit Din. I don't want to go through this. Therefore, I'm not going to get married. So in order to facilitate them getting married, we make it easier for them to come collect. We make it easier in this case. And therefore, even for the Yorshim, we're going to say they can do it without Beit Din, because there are times where there are female Yorshim. And for the female Yorshim, this will be an issue. Chayin will be an issue, not just the case of Bizui. Right, next Mishnah, part of which we quoted before, which is Machra Tubata. If she sells her Tubah, Omiksata, or a portion of it, Meshkana Ktubata, she gave her Ktubah as Klaro, Omiksata, or a portion of it, Natna Ktubata Lacher, she gives her Ktubah to another party, Omiksata, or a portion of it, Lo Timkor Tashar, Ela Beit Din. The remainder can only be sold through Beit Din. I mean, the collection on the remainder of the Ktubah is only done through the normal channels of Beit Din. Chamim Amim, Mukherdi, Afilu Arba'a V'chamisha Piyamim. If she slowly collects her ktubah over a 4 or 5 time periods, she in each time can sell the land without going to Beit Din in order to collect her ktubah. Umucheret the mizonot shelo beBeit Din. This we've seen before. She's allowed to sell without Beit Din in order to collect her mizonot. Bekotevet the mizonot macharti. In that case, she'll have to identify that she's selling it for mizonot. So in this instance, where she's already sold a portion of the property to fulfill her ktubah, she's still entitled to collect mizonot from the estate until she collects fully on her ktubah. That's the Chachamim's position. Therefore, she can continue to sell property without Beit Din to get mizonot. But there she will have to identify that she's selling it for mizonot, because she's already started to collect her ktubah. So she has to make it clear that she's selling here for mizonot and not for the collection of the remainder of her ktubah. V'gusha lo timkor ela beBeit Din. And a divorcee cannot sell except in Beit Din. And that was the Mishnah that we quoted before. I understand, according to one who says the Dvaze Ishto, Grusha, makes sense. But for Chayin still is applicable by a Grusha. So why doesn't it apply over here? So the Gemara, this statement in this Mishnah, according to the one who Amar Rabbi Yochanan, who says it's Dvaze Ishto, it's Kuliyama says this. Everybody agrees to this. According to Ula, who says the issue is Chayin, this line in the Mishnah is only according to Rabbi Shimon of the previous Mishnah. It's Rabbi Shimon who demands that a Grusha only sell in Beit Din, but the Chachamim or the Tanakama of the previous Mishnah would disagree and say you do not need to sell in Beit Din because of Chayin. And Chayin is applicable to a Grusha. Not according to Rabbi Shimon, but according to the Tanakhama it is. So Gemara says, Matnitan Mani, who's the author of our Mishnah? Rabbi Shimoni, he must be the author of the Mishnah. The Tanya, Machrak Tubata, Mashkena Tubata, she sold her Tubah, she gave it as collateral, Astak Tubata Putuki, Leacher, Ein La Mizonot, or she gave it as directed collateral to someone else, Ein La Mizonot, she's no longer entitled to Mizonot. Rabbi Shimon Omer, only a portion of it, avda mizonota, then she loses out her mizonot. So now, Rabbi Shimon over here disagrees with the Tanakhama. You see in the parentheses, Divrei Rabbi Meir, because Rabbi Meir is deemed to be the Tanakhama. It's a stam statement over here, so it's stam is Rabbi Meir. So we assume Rabbi Meir is the author of the first position, Rabbi Shimon is the author of the second position. In Rabbi Shimon's opinion, it says here, if you liquidate a portion of your ktubah, you're no longer entitled to mizonot. So now if we go into our Mishnah, the Tanakhama of our Mishnah, who argues on the Chachamim, says, when you liquidate a portion of your ktubah, you have to go to Beit Din afterwards. Well, why do you have to go to Beit Din afterwards? Well, if you're not entitled to mizonot, then you have to go to Beit Din. That's Rabbi Shimon's opinion. So Rabbi Shimon over here in this Braita says that if you've liquidated a portion of your ktubah, you're no longer entitled to mizonot. You're no longer entitled to mizonot, then you gotta go to Beit Din to collect the remainder of your tubah. According to Rabbi Meir, who says that even when you've sold a portion of it, you still don't go to Beit Din, that's like the Chachamim's position in our Mishnah, that as long as you're still not collected your full tubah, you're entitled to mizonot, and you continue to sell without Beit Din in order to get her mizonot. And now the Gemara says, the Memra, to Rabbi Shimon Savar, to Lo Amrei Mitzad Kesef Kekol Kesef. So now, it sounds like from Rabbi Shimon that we don't say that a portion of her ktubah is enough to consider as if she has her whole ktubah. I mean, as long as there is some portion of the ktubah left, it's as if she's still in the estate and she still has the ability to collect mizonot. Rabbi Shimon does not say that. He says as soon as you took a portion out of it, it's as if you're out. And Rabbanan Savri Amri Mitzad Kesef Kekol Kesef. And therefore the Chachamim hold the other way around, which is, as long as there's a portion of the Ketubah left, it's as if the entire Ketubah is still left. So Rabbi Shimon sees a collection of portion of the Ketubah as if it wipes out the rights. As if you collected your whole Ketubah. The Chachamim are the other way around. If you only took a portion of it, it's as if the whole Ketubah is still outstanding. Ha'ib Chashmenin Lohu. We've seen the opposite in their positions. D'tanya, we have a Braita that we saw in Yivamot. V'hu isha b'vtudah yikach. So this is talking about the Kohen Gadol. He has to take a woman who is a betula for a wife. Prat lebogeret shikalu betulotea divi Rabbi Meir. But Meir says you cannot marry a bogeret because her betulot already have diminished. She has diminished betulot, even naturally. Just naturally her betulot have diminished as she's come of age and moved into the age of bogeret. Rabbi Lazar, Rabbi Shimon, machshirim bebogeret. Rabbi Lazar and Rabbi Shimon say you can marry a bogeret. That's still classified as a betula. So there, Gemara, seemingly, they're arguing about this issue. What is mitzat? When you have a portion, what is that classified as? Oh. Rabbi Meir sounds like, if you have a portion, that's not classified as the whole. Because if she has mitzat betulim, that's not as if she's an entire betula. Yet over here, he says, if you have a portion of the ketubah still outstanding, that's as if the entire ketubah is still outstanding. Seemingly, that's an opposing position. And same thing with Rabbi Shimon. Rabbi Shimon over here says, as long as a portion of her betulot are there, she's considered to be a full-fledged betula. You know, over here, if she collects a portion of her ketubah, she's not considered as if she still has her full ketubah outstanding. It's as if she's out of the picture. So, hotam bikrai pligay. Over there, the machloket is not about a logical argument. It's not an argument about how you view mixat. It's an argument how you interpret the psukim. So over there, you can't take that argument and extrapolate it to other cases because there it's a unique argument about the psukim. Rabbi Meir Savar, betula. The pasuk could have said betula. It says, v'hu isha bivtuleha ikach. So now, it could have used the word betula. Betula would have told us, afilu mixat betulim. Betula means any part of betulim, even if she only has a portion of a betulim, which means a bogeret, would have been fine. Betuleha, betula comes, adika, kulu. So then it comes to teach you that you need kulu betulim. Everything has to be there. That means that a bogeret is now disqualified. Biv tuleha, what is the bet add there? Bikidarkain, shlokidarka alo. That's only if she has her betulim bikidarka. But if she has it shlobikidarka, then we would not say that. Rabbi Lazar, Rabbi Shimon Sabre. So you'll see from Rabbi Lazar, Rabbi Shimon, that will shed light on Rabbi Meir's position, which is bitula shlema mashma. Bitula means she's gotta have all of her betulim, that would exclude a bogeret. Bituleha comes to teach you, afilu mixat betulim. Even if only a portion of the betulim are there. So the real question here is, what is the default? When you say the word betula, Rabbi Meir says the default is, any amount of betulim is sufficient. Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Lazar say no. Betula means even the full betulim. So that's the default. Now when I get the word betula, what does it do? According to Rabbi Meir, it says the default is even mixed up betulim. Betula comes along and says you have to have full betulim. According to Rabbi Lazar, Rabbi Shimon says the default of betula means full betulim. Then when it says bitula, it's reducing it down to even mixa bitulim. Then bivtulea, she call bitulea kayamim. And she has to have all of her bitulim. Ben bikadarka, ben shlokidarka. So according to Rabbi Lazar, Rabbi Shimon, there, if she's had biyah with a man, whether it's kidarka, bimakom bitulim, whether she's had it shlokidarka, shlobimakom bitulim, then she is deemed to be, she's no longer a bitula. In case of biyah shlokidarka, she's no longer deemed to be a bitula, and she cannot marry the Kohen Gadol. Even though she has the physical bitulim there, but because she's had bi'ah, shalok edarka, she's deemed to be eina bitula. On the other hand, Rabbi Meir says, bivtula comes to teach you that only b'makom bitulim is she deemed to be not a bitula. But if it's shalok edarka, she's still deemed to be a bitula, and she can marry the Kohen Gadol. So, inyan bi'ila, whether she's considered to be a bi'ula or not, according to Rabbi Lazar, Rabbi Shimon, if she has the shaloka darka, she's a bi'ula, even though she has her betulim intact. On the other hand, for Rabbi Meir, if she has bi'ah shaloka darka, she's still deemed to be a bi'tula, because her betulim are intact. Now, that might have to do with the progression of their limud. Right? Rabbi Meir starts out that the default is mixat betulim. Then the next limud teaches you she has to have full betulim. Then bi'tula comes to teach you those full betulim. If that's where the issue is, then she's no longer a bitula. If the issue is from somewhere else, then she's not deemed to be a bitula, because her full bitulim are what matter. Because, according to Rabbi Meir, if already the mixat bitulim is enough to knock out a bogeret, then mitzvah betulim should be enough to knock out shalok edarka. The fact that the Torah came and gave you an additional bet over there must be inclusive rather than exclusive. Because if they wanted to be exclusive, it would have said nothing more, and it would have been sufficient to know that shalok edarka ruined it for her. So the fact that now the Torah comes back and says bibtula must mean that it's coming to include a case of shalok edarka, that's not disqualified from the bitula. According to Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Shimon, you start out the default of bitula is at full bitulim. Bivtula says even mixat bitulim is good enough. That means bivtula means that anything that changes their status at that point is enough. We don't care because mixat bitulim is not enough. It's the fact that she has not been a bitula. So therefore here, in a case of bitula, where she was shalok edarka, she's going to get disqualified, even though her mixat bitulim are still intact, because it's bivtula. Even when the case where she has mixat bitulim, that will not suffice. Meaning that perush beinan sheotan mixat betulim yeh kayamim b'chol makom, that those mixat betulim have to exist whether it's kedarka or shalok kedarka, and therefore shalok kedarka would be deemed to be a beula according to Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Shimon. So here, see, the machloket revolves around the interpretation of the psukim, not about a svara, it's about whether mixat is considered to be the whole. And therefore, over here they can have a different opinion, because over here it's a logical argument: is how do you view the mixat? Okay, we're going to stop here. Two lines down on the top of Tzadik Chet Omer Aleph.